This is Pia from Opinory and a new episode of OML Media. On this podcast, we're interviewing the most interesting minds and people from the media industry. Today with Nick Carlson, Editor-in-Chief of Business Insider. And as we're a German company and have a large German audience, let me say hello to our German listeners. Hallo zu einer neuen Folge OML Media, dieses Mal mit dem Chefredakteur von Business Insider, den ich in New York getroffen habe. Es ist gar nicht so leicht, Nick richtig festzunageln auf einer Aussage, wie das mit Amerikanern ja manchmal so ist. Wir haben einige Pirouetten gedreht, als es zum Beispiel um ihre Zahlen ging, aber hört selbst, back to English. Business Insider has the ambition to balance massive reach and quality journalism, and I try to understand how that actually works. What else we talked about, how is it to be acquired by a German company, how he sees other venture-backed media companies like BuzzFeed, Vice, Mike, who all had a very tough last year, while Business Insider was in a much more comfortable post-exit position. We talked about how they raise quality of their content, how they measure performance, whom Nick looks up to from the competitor's landscape. But let's hand over to Nick. Have fun with this interview. Hi, Nick.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm especially good because I'm here. You have been at Business Insider since 11 years, correct?
Yeah, almost 11 years. It'll be 11 years in October, so I guess 10 and a half years.
Okay, 10 and a half years. And probably inherited 50 different jobs in that time.
Exactly. People sometimes say, why have you been there so long? How is that possible?
Because it's changing all the time.
That's a long time. But yes, we have literally been in five or six different offices. And this hopefully will be our office for a long time. But we've been in a lot of different offices. And then I've also had five or six different jobs. So now
as editor-in-chief of about 250 editors?
Yeah, 265 plus somewhere. Adding more.
And across a number of global editions and verticals. Give me your typical day. How does a typical day of Nick Carlson look like?
Yeah, great. So, I mean, I'm in a lot of meetings, and that's probably where most of my time goes. And it's usually meeting with people and just figuring out, what are we working on and how can we get better and what more can we do and what can we stop doing and who do we need to hire and how do we need to manage? And then when I'm really lucky, I have a couple meetings a day where I'm deep talking about a story or a plan or something around precisely editorial. I like all the other parts, but the reason I'm so into it is to get to push the thing forward in terms of specific stories sometimes. So
one of your explicit goals this year was to elevate Insider's storytelling and journalism with more breakout stories and investigations, features, documentaries.
That's right.
In video, text, and audio. So what has changed since January where you stated this as a goal?
Right. So, I mean, I think the team's been doing great work. We did great work last year. I mean, but we this year have hired a few specialists who can kind of just focus on a few of these projects. So we're excited to have someone in-house who can take all the ideas that a lot of us have had here and be the project manager for those investigations and kind of get them out at a more regular clip and hopefully with more impact.
So how on this annual goal, on what percentage are you there?
It's never as fast as I want. You know, I mean, so we were joking recently that a Q2 or Q1 goal to like get going on a project first means you hire someone. And so then they might come in the middle of Q2 and then they get up to speed by Q3. And so it's like, you know, ask me how we're doing in 2020.
I can relate to this. How do you measure the uplift in quality?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Actually, that's one that we have an analytics editor here. Her title is Executive Growth Editor. Her name is Emily Cohen, and you know, she and I have been talking about how, you know, I wrote this letter, I think, which is what you're referring to, which is about a goal for this year is to get better at time well spent.
Yeah.
And so what I mean by that, I'll just sort of, you know, break it down what I meant by that, which is that there's this philosopher out in Silicon Valley, his name's Tristan Harris, and he used to work at Google, and he noticed that Google and other Silicon Valley tech companies, the platforms, were really optimizing for time spent. And that meant that that was leading them to do all kinds of, like, what he viewed were bad habits. They actually went out and reversed.
You don't want to be the drug, like, or the comparison to social platforms that make... that drive addiction of their users.
Exactly. They went out and reversed engineered addiction. They tried to figure out, like, why do people go to slot machines?
Yeah.
And even when they know the house is going to win. And so they built that same, they took what that human flaw was and they built it into the design of the platforms. And he's very concentrated on the tech companies, but I think media companies, which fill up the feeds of these social platforms, have a responsibility themselves to make sure that we're not publishing stuff that that leaves you with that feeling you get when you're stuck in a social media hole. I like to think about, like, a contrast. Contrasts are helpful for me. And so the contrast is, the feeling of, like, when you go home after work and you sit on the couch and you open up Instagram and, like, 25 minutes later, you're like, what just happened to me? And you have this, like, sinking, caved-in feeling in the solar plexus.
Having gone down this rabbit hole.
Yeah. You feel a little bit – honestly, you feel a little bit closer to death, you know?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. And then – or the feeling of, like, you know, I read In Cold Blood this year, like, from by Truman Capote, and I closed that book and I was just like – oh my God. You know, like that feeling, you know, I'm not saying our stories are.
But how, how do you measure this feeling?
Yeah,
that
it's very difficult. I actually don't know how to measure it yet. We're gonna keep thinking about it and working on it. But I do think it's something that I can say to the team constantly. Like, look, we're measuring, you know, how well you're engaging with the audience. Those metrics, that data, it's imperfect. You know, we know that, like, there are a lot of ways to get a lot of traffic. There are a lot of ways to get subscribers. It's almost their job to be, like, the arbiters of quality, like the people who, like, don't do bad habits, don't publish bad things. And so it's kind of like it's the hard part, honestly. It's like saying to them, like, let's just make sure we publish good stuff that leaves people feeling like they got something out of the story, the video, the article, and leave them with something.
I want to dive deeper into your editorial agenda and your famous quirky acronym. But first...
Yeah, I know what that is.
I want to hear about your acquisition that happened fairly recently. Yeah. Axel Springer now owns about 97%.
They own the whole thing. The 3% you were talking about is right when they bought us in 2015. Jeff Bezos didn't sell his last little piece.
Smart.
But then a year or so later, I asked Henry, my boss, about Henry Blodgett, the CEO, and he said, "Oh no, that's been taken care of." So now Axel Springer does it in the whole thing.
Well, okay. Yeah. So how is it to operate with the Germans?
You know, like, this will sound annoying, but they're really great owners. I mean, they really are.
What kind? Can you describe great? Yeah. I mean, how are they?
Yeah.
As
why do you say great? A few reasons. The number one reason is that I think that they are a company that trusts the people who run their businesses to run their businesses. They're not like, you know, they want to know how it's working and they have great advice and they have like, and we have a few executives here, who have come from Berlin. But for the most part, they acquired this company because they think that Henry was doing a great job and had a great staff and they want more of that. And they want to, like, enable the vision that was already in place and just sort of supercharge it and provide resources. And then they have high expectations for us and our performance. And, you know, one reason why it's a happy marriage so far is that we've performed against those expectations, which is great. Of course, you know, if we falter, maybe things would change, but right now they're good. And then the other piece that I really like, about them as owners. And there are a few things. I mean, first off, it's nice to be not a venture-backed media company right now. That's helpful because...
some of last year's developments.
Yeah, you saw some of the things that happened to some of the venture-backed media companies. And, like, that's not a... It's not criticizing those companies. They had a mission that was, you know, literally their owners were asking them to achieve. Like, you know...
Would you have been under similar threat if you wouldn't have been acquired?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have... first off, Henry's always been a very cautious steward of capital, so to speak. You know, like, he's been someone who... even if we think of things, you know, really working, we'll do a little bit more. We won't do a lot of bit more right away. And sometimes it's frustrating, but it also has kept us over our skis, is that a German expression as well? Stay over your skis. I'm sure it is. Germans love to ski as well.
But Axel Springer is a huge name in continental Europe, but yes, maybe less in the US.
A very not a known name here.
Exactly. So what did you do concretely to get your teams and employees excited about the acquisition and your new owner?
Yeah, well, it's just, I think that there's truth about, it's a journalism company. You know, like, I've met many members of the board over there, starting with Matthias Doffner. Many of them are former journalists, and Matthias, you know, himself was, and they all, the company is named after someone who really believed in journalism so much that, as the story goes, built the headquarters right on the Berlin Wall and broadcast news into East Germany. Now, when I was there, I noticed that, like, East Germany then built up some housing buildings to block the so the news didn't get through, so the effort may have gone to waste. But anyway, I take it for its point. And it just does come through that the company really does care about journalism. And that matters. That's great. That's very helpful for recruiting. It matters to me. And so, you know, like, sometimes you sit and you wonder, like, you know, why does this classifieds company want to bother with media? You know, like, it's so much more profitable not to be in media. And I think it's because they really, really think it's important.
But you see credibility there.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I think even Frieda Springer seems to be very passionate about journalism.
Has Frieda been to the...
She's visited. Yes, yes. Ah. She came. Uh-huh. It was lovely. Uh-huh. Yes.
So, where do you think they benefit from your skills and expertise or experience, and where do you benefit from them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we benefit...
On a strategic...
On a strategic level, I think that... I like to think that we're on a big... let me see. How do we benefit from them? First off, just having good owners who are patient and are long-term, you know, hopefully permanent owners of this company is a very different position than being in a company that's looking for your ownership group. You know, who's gonna become your acquirer, and instead you can build long-term value. Just, you know, them being that kind of like consistent owner of the company, looking for long-term value out of us that's incredibly, you know, and by the way, that's not every potential, some acquirers I know, I won't get into who it was, wanted to buy us and change us. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted us to stop doing thing and stop doing that and like fit into their organization. And, you know, Henry, to his credit, was like, nah, not interested in those types of things. And so, that mode of acquisition is very smart. That doesn't mean we don't like to partner with Bild and Welt and many of the other, actually some of our international editions are like licensees who have licensed our brand, and they're actually Axel Springer companies. And so,
but where do you think, when it's not only about partnering with Welt and Bild, mm-hmm. where do they get benefit from?
Where do they get benefit from us? Yeah, great question. Well, we are the United States' second largest news publication by reach. And so it's funny to look at the list of top news publishers in the country. And if you look at the list and then you look at the amount of revenue and value, kind of like maybe market cap of the brand that is each of those, or mm-hmm. like the revenue generated by each of those. Mm-hmm. We're doing well, mm-hmm. but we are way underperforming like where the rest of media that is that size. And so I think in us, they are making a bet that having so much reach and so much engagement long-term will provide just tremendous value to their shareholders. And then also, I think on the journalism mission, you know, this is a very, very big market. And a lot of people here, you know, it's maybe the world's most important and wealthiest market. And so I think we, in many ways, are a good bet here for them to own it. You know, I mean, I think we have long-term ambitions for them to be in a place 50 years from now where, like, look, Insider is a dominant and most loved media brand in the world. And Axel Springer is a a very happy beneficiary of it.
And they recently doubled down on their data strategy and data ownership. Are you sharing a data management platform with them and with the other Access Springer brands, or are you keeping them separate?
I would be going out of my depth if I offered an answer on that one, other than to say I think we do partner with them some on data. Uh-huh. But don't hold me to this. I don't think that we're in a deep data collaboration at this moment. But at the same time, perhaps we are, and I just don't know.
And if they said, like now join our data pool and no separation anymore at all, would this be bothering for you?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It depends what it looks like. Yeah. Depends what the advantages are. There's like lots of great ways to partner, and there's lots of ways that would be terrible. So, you know, I think that, like... Look, I don't know. Depends. Don't Devil's in the details. There's another one.
Yeah. So you mentioned your impressive numbers. So how many unique visitors do you have right now?
Yeah, so we have two websites, and then we have a video network,
Business
basically.
Insider.
Yeah,
Insider.
So Business Insider, it's like one of these things where it's like really big. So it's like 100 million people come to Business Insider every month, and then about 40 million people come to Insider.com every month. And then we have a video platform where we are getting, you know, 500, 600, 700 million 30-second video views every month across all platforms.
So what overall user number do you communicate?
I mean, I don't know. At this point, you know, that was like a kind of a snarky answer, and I apologize. But like, I think actually,
it's okay.
I think here's how I really think about it. Mm-hmm. Business Insider, it's huge. Mm-hmm. It's great. I'm so glad it's big. Mm-hmm. Like, let's get to the point where everybody who is a professional and wants to know what's going on in their industry and the companies they care about are reading it five times a month at least, or maybe more. And so, in terms of like monthly total reach numbers, they're good. I want them to go up. I don't want them to go down, but I really want DAUs to go up, and I want people's like engagement with the brand to go further. And I think that just sort of like, yes, we are huge. We were acquired. It's great. I mean, I've been here almost 4.5 years since our acquisition. No, actually almost 3.5 years, whatever math. But for me, what's motivating is that there's so much further to go. Mm-hmm. You know, like Business Insider can be just Business Insider. We have other publications, but just thinking for a minute about Business Insider, you know, we're big. That's cool. We've been big. We've been the number one business publication since 2015. And let's now like have more impact and more deeply engage with our readers. And
one way to deeply engage with your brand is to pay.
Yes. So yes, exactly.
How many subscribers do you have right now?
Well, I can't give you an exact number, but that's good. That was so casually asked. That was good. I liked it. How many subs? We're ahead of plan, like to offer like an annoying sense. It's going well. It's going.
So the FT recently got 1 million paying subscribers. How far are you from that goal?
Somewhat far. Very far. Okay. That's a great goal. You know what's cool about our subscriber business is that we didn't need to launch it out of like desperation. So, you know, it's like, I don't know if this got all the way to Germany, but there was this phrase going around, pivot to video.
Yes.
So like in 2015, everyone was pivoting to video.
I heard DigiDay saying you pivoted to business
after launching your product. That was so rude, and yet I have repeated it a few times. It's a very rude thing to say. Brian Morrissey said that. Hi, Brian. So we have many subscribers and more all the time, and how you can tell it's working is we are, you know, rapidly investing.
What's the split between ad revenues and subscription revenues?
Oh, ad revenues way outpace subscription revenues at this point. I mean, like subscription revenues
90% to 10% or 95%.
That's good. Yeah, you're like, I like this. This is a lot. You want a job?
At least.
That's good.
I have a job.
I'm not going to tell you. Let's turn off the tape recorder and I'll tell you. No, I won't. No, it's going really well, and we're hiring more people. We are soon going to have the largest team covering finance in the world, like the finance industry.
But you're called crazily efficient in your numbers of editors generating, or with the impact that you're driving.
So yes. It is efficient, but I think we do have room to hire a lot more people. And here's why. I'll explain. I mean, you know, one of the coolest things about Prime is that, which is our subscription product, BI Prime, is that it enables us to cover industries and companies in a way that we did in our very beginning, but then as we scaled, we were unable to. So when I came to this company 10 and a half years ago, I covered AOL every single day. AOL by then was already kind of like a defunct has-been company that not a lot of people cared about. But I wrote about it every day because just before I joined, Henry Blodgett wrote a story saying layoffs were coming to AOL. He posted actually a picture that someone sent him of moving boxes. And in that moment, you know, everybody at the company realized that the best source of information about what the company was going to do was not rival publications. It wasn't PR. It wasn't even their own management. It was this blog, Silicon Alley Insider. And we cracked the company, is what we would say in those days. But I would write about AOL every day because I would get like 1,000 or 2,000 page views with every story. Well, then as we scaled and became aimed for and really embraced the advertising model, getting, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 page views for a good story on a small company didn't really cut it. And it meant that I kind of had to abandon my AOL coverage and focus on larger targets. And so did we as a newsroom. We had to focus on big companies that, like, a lot of people would immediately want to click on stories about them. And that's
what's
that's
the most clickable company you're covering?
For a long time it was Apple. Yeah. It's actually surprising, but it's less so now. Uh-huh. It's less so now. Tesla's right there now. What a story Tesla is. So the interesting thing is that the coolest thing about Prime is that it has returned us to being able to write about companies. We can now write about companies where the audience size doesn't need to be in the tens, you know, like the story, the article itself doesn't need to reach tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. It can reach, you know, like hundreds of people. But if they're the right hundreds of people, yep, and they're like subscribing to our Business Insider Prime because of it, then it just got paid for.
So what split are you aiming for
there is an official answer to this, and it reveals a little bit where my brain is that I don't know. Uh-huh. I personally love subscriptions. I sometimes talk about like swimming to subscription island, you know, like I like the programmatic advertising business. The direct sales business is nice when you work with great partners who can underwrite coverage that's important to me and tell great stories, help us tell great stories.
Here comes a quick German break for our sponsors. Please bear with me, dear non-Germans. Es gibt einen Sponsoren und ein Geburtstagskind, Spiegel Plus. Ich glaube, eine der ganz wenigen deutschen Medienmarken, die auch in den USA jeder kennt, und das muss einen Grund haben. Spiegel Plus ist die digitale Verheiratung von Nachrichten am Puls der Zeit, wie man es von Spohn kennt, und tiefgehender Recherche, exklusiven Geschichten aus dem Heft, eigenen exklusiven Spiegel Plus Geschichten. Nicht nur Politik, sondern auch Ernährung, Finanzen, Familie etc. Das Rezo-Interview von vor ein paar Tagen war zum Beispiel meine letzte Spiegel Plus Perle. Und jedenfalls wird Spiegel Plus jetzt ein Jahr alt und verteilt Geburtstagsgeschenke für sich selber. Auf spiegel.de/Kuchen kriegt man Spiegel Plus für 6 Monate für 10 Euro im Monat statt doppelten 19,99 €. Also 50% Rabatt monatlich kündbar. spiegel.de/Kuchen. Viel Spaß damit. Und zurück zu Nick. Okay, from this massive traffic you're generating, what are the top 3 markets?
You know what's interesting? I mean, so the top 3 markets, I mean, we're large in, I can tell you our, weirdly, I think it's the United States, I think it's, and then the UK, and then probably Canada, you know, big English speaking countries. We have a big Australia team too. But you know what's really fascinating is we have a partner in Poland who does very, very well, and Warsaw, and our whole network is like our fourth most engaged city of all of them, or third most or something like that, ahead of like maybe perhaps Chicago. So that's pretty fascinating.
And
I know.
The German team just got replaced.
They're moving to Berlin, and hopefully that's out there.
I heard Ben Smith saying on this podcast, who has some experience with the German market as well, that he finds the Germans' use of the internet one of the oddest things that he knows.
Yes.
And it includes the challenges of building a new publisher brand in Germany.
I think it's hard. I think that in lots of areas of Europe, it seems like newspapers are still healthier than they are here. Yep. Yep. You know,
yep.
I mean, even here,
and the legacy brands
here, we have
are
some very large, very healthy newspapers. It's just the local ones that are suffering.
So, you use this quirky, crazy acronym Schaff, which sounds like a German word.
It really does sound German. Like, you know, I think it was invented well before we were acquired. It does sound German.
So it's spelled
S-C-H-A-F-F-F-F, four F's.
Okay. Did it start with four F's or do you keep adding F's?
F's got added. The C got added. The C sometimes drops out. Is the C in your version?
The C is my, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Sometimes the C gets dropped.
So it stands
like
for
C, so.
Smart.
Conversational. Helpful, accurate, fair, fast, fearless, and fun.
Okay.
I might have gotten the order of the F's wrong.
It's okay. I didn't notice. Give me an example of what kind of story covers the range of criteria you described.
All of them?
Schaff. Or like epitomes.
How about Elon
for
Musk smoking a joint?
Epitomes of separate of each of those.
One for each, a story for each of them.
Yeah.
Wow, that's hard. I can't do that. But I will tell you a story that hits a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's like, what is it? Just the Elon Musk saga from last year when he, you know, tweeted funding secured at $420. And then, you know, a few weeks later, he's smoking weed on a Joe Rogan podcast.
That's very conversational.
Yeah.
But the C.
And the yeah, exactly. It's fast and we probably did it quickly. And then it's fearless in the sense of like, that one, is that fearless? I think that's fearless enough in that. Oh yeah, sure. Our reporter Lynette Lopez was getting blasted on Twitter by Elon Musk himself. You know, and she was sort of courageously continued to do her coverage. And like, look, people think that, oh, that's not a big deal. That's just a social media call out. Well, it's like, okay, well, you try being a woman on social media when a man like that powerful with that many followers attacks you and see what kind of like replies you get. And mm-hmm. It's nasty. And so that's fearless, and that's Lynette. And then accurate, of course, we're all over that. Fair, you know, however, is that, you know, our coverage of Musk didn't change. It wasn't like because he was negative toward Lynette Lopez or because he was sort of, you know, it didn't change Matthew DeBord's reviews of Tesla or his products or, you know, a fair analysis of what was going on with the company. And fun, you know, fun is all covering the story and covering lots of angles on it. You know, yep. I mean, like that's important. That's the BI thing. It's like, look, business coverage does not have to be boring. It does not have to be, you know, this kind of staid prose where some editor makes everything sound the same. And no, you really can't talk about Elon Musk's girlfriend who like has, you know, put on Snapchat this interesting image. I think that happened. Or actually, it wasn't his girlfriend. What was it? It was his friend of his girlfriend who's like, she's a musician, and all of a sudden she like started, I think, posting on either Snapchat or Instagram about a weird stay she had there. You know, it's a story for us, and we're like, let's do it, let's go. People want to know about that.
I think fan is also synonym for or relates to my moments of deep procrastination where I click something because I because it attracts me, and then I just stay there for a while.
And hopefully
not with the hopefully not with this rabbit hole feeling.
But exactly. Hopefully you're there and you're glad you spent time with it. I mean, I know, I'm not to say, by the way, not to say we're perfect on the sticking with us and not getting and feeling like you didn't get something out of it.
I have another question on related to this. You said on a different podcast you're not regarding the audience from insider, from the entertainment fun part, as a funnel leading into paid.
No, I don't think so.
Prime. So, but do you actually treat them as isolated target groups? And how do you ensure that users understand the difference? Because in the first place, I didn't.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm not too worried about that. Yeah, I'm not too worried about that. Really, what Insider Inc. is Insider Insider. You know, we did a hard thing. We launched Business Insider, and it grew very successful, and it grew very large, and one way it grew large, not the only way, but the one way it grew large is we were very like generous, liberal about the idea of what business coverage was. We covered politics, we covered science, we covered some sports, and we occasionally would hear from people, that's not business, why are you doing that? And we just wanted to, we continued to want to tell those stories. And so we created a new brand sort of called Insider, and we put those stories there. And so look, really what Insider does is engage the digital generation at scale, meaningfully engage the digital generation at scale. And we're going to hit some people who really don't care about business that much, and they'll probably end up seeing Insider more than they see Business Insider. But the people who want to know what's going on to the companies that matter to them and the markets that matter to them, they'll get the same kind of Insider style coverage of the world on business. And on that, they'll get Business Insider. So the sub-brand really long-term is Business Insider Insider. Of Insider. But at the same time, if you're a Business Insider reader and you never see Insider, that's fine too. You know, we also have things like Food Insider, Cars Insider.
Yep.
And if you're just on those all the time and you like that and you don't want to see the other stuff, that's fine with us.
And across these two names, domains, what data are you using to understand what a reader wants to read?
Yeah, we do a lot of data analysis. I mean, really, like, so I, in this very room, I interview a lot of people for jobs, and they often ask me, what is my beat? And I say to them, your beat is to imagine, you know, you, here's how you discover your beat. This is your job. This is your career. Picture a Venn diagram. The Venn diagram is like one circle is, you know, all the topics and coverage areas that are the audience is super passionate about. And then the other circle, which overlays this hopefully in some ways, is the what you're passionate about. And in that overlap is your beat. Like, that's what you need to do. Maybe that's what we hired you for.
And what exactly are you using to define the circle number one?
What are they passionate about? Yeah. So the three ways we, many different ways. So one thing we do is we, every quarter, many of the teams here will look at the top 100 best performing stories, and then they'll look at a sample of the middle 100 performing stories, and they'll do like a 27 variable analysis of both and see how they're different, and then make decisions based on that. And that can be things like how long a headline should be, how many images we should use in a post, what kinds of stories we should write about. So we do like deep granular analysis like that. Sometimes it's much simpler than that.
I think one challenge there is, it's easy to identify the like obvious interests areas from what we users from time on site to clicks to scroll depth, etc. But then I think it's much harder to understand the underserved niche audiences where you have the potential to build an audience.
Totally. And the way you get there is you have to tell people, we have an expression for this. This is not a United States expression or an English expression. This is a
German expression.
No, it's like an Insider Inc. one.
Okay.
And so we say you have to expand the list. Like, so we have a long list. We are 11 or 12 years old now as a company. We have a long list. We know it works. You know, like, it changes. It shrinks. Actually, the list shrinks because people stop being into a certain topic. So because of that, because it's shrinking, you constantly have to be trying new things, and you have to be saying, well, maybe we should try this instead. Like, you know, so I'm going to do a bunch of stuff that I know is going to work, and then I'm going to try a bunch of things that I don't know if they're going to work. And if we're not doing that, and I don't just mean like topic area, I'm also talking about like kinds of story, like, or even like format. You know, if you're not doing that, you just end up with a shrinking list of things that work until there's nothing on it anymore. And so, for example, and that's where that other, that, by the way, so how do you think of things to try? So in terms of topic, you think back to that list of things you're passionate about. So like, we had a reporter who came in here a year ago. She's relatively junior. And I say that only to say that it's really exciting to have junior people here who do this kind of thing. And she said, why don't we cover the trucking industry? Mm-hmm. And so we started, and I think one of her editors said, okay, try it, you know? And now she's actually off at Chicago Booth doing a some sort of fellowship, but she will come back. Her name's Rachel Premack. Rachel, you better come back.
And it worked.
And it worked. And it was like one of our biggest topics ever. And no one would have thought that. And that one of the cool things about our newsroom is that it's very egalitarian. And so it's like, we're not a top-down newsroom. As much as I would like to say I can take credit for everything that's going on the site today, I don't. I instead hire people who know what's a good idea to greenlight. And we also...
I think that's a thing German... Just companies can learn from you.
And we definitely favor... We are biased toward... experimentation, and we are biased toward people saying, like, make it happen.
On the opposite side from the trucking niche, what is a topic area that you find super, super interesting yourself, but your audience totally doesn't?
That's great. Probably a lot of things. Like, I mean, like, I have a very specific... Well, I follow Dortmund, Borussia Dortmund, which is a Bundesliga
Borussia
team.
Borussia Dortmund? Please stop covering Borussia Dortmund.
I don't think my team is, I don't think they're, there's a lot of traffic in it for us. Although I do think there's probably a subscription product in that. I think that, I think actually some of our corporate cousins do have a successful subscription product covering the Bundesliga very closely. And I think there's an interesting company called The Athletic, which is launched here. And I think that that's their model, is they pick like even the small teams, and then they kind of figure out.
I was at a conference last week, and they talked a lot about AI in newsrooms.
Yeah.
What is your...
We, you know, not much.
Thanks for this answer. I was I wanted to ask this question, but then I was scared that it there would be a lot of bullshitting.
You know what I like are editors, like real intelligence.
So okay, that's what I thought when I read a different interview of yours where you described how your editors are supposed to like internalize the data or
that's right. So metrics. You can see, like, we have monitors on the wall that list off our most popular stories on the site right now, and we have all sort of analytics available to them. We send them emails sort of updating on what's performing here and there, and the idea is to sort of surround them with data so that they create a feedback loop where it's like consciously they're trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work, but also subconsciously it's like just in their brains. So
okay, Nick, we're getting to the end.
Yes.
So there are two more small buckets of questions.
Great.
One is the bucket of questions that I missed to ask in the course of our conversation. Uh-huh. And then in the end, I would get really frustrated with myself to have missed these questions. I want to ask them.
We don't want you to be frustrated. So.
One is, why would I pay for
Business Insider Prime?
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg.
Well, okay. First up,
the short version.
One of these were a lot more fun than those publications.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're written in a very dry style. We are chaff. And then we have, I would like to say, I think I really admire the Wall Street Journal as a publication for sure. I mean, the way they led the, and it was a big story here. I'm sure it was, I know that it penetrated over there, but the Michael Cohen Stormy Daniels story was pretty much owned by the Wall Street Journal, and it was really impressive. But that's actually kind of indicative of where the Wall Street Journal is. And it's like, I don't want to challenge them to do this, but they kind of have decided to be a big general interest publication to compete with the New York Times, and they're doing a good job at it. And in that, I think they've left a little room in the market for really great business reporting on companies and markets that matter to today's leaders and tomorrow's leaders. Mm-hmm. And so if you're one of those people and you want to know what's going on in your industry, we may not have gotten to your industry yet, but we are going industry by industry, market by market, really exploring them from the inside, like taking you inside the room. Mm-hmm. So the example I used with our team to kind of give them a sense of like the value proposition we provide for our readers and what they should be aiming for as reporters and editors is I was meeting with a room full of editors, and I had my my managing editor to my side, and I said, you know, what if a Digiday reporter got access to my emails or somehow they were leaked to them, and in those emails I was talking to my managing editor, her name's Jess Lieben, about the editors in this room that I thought were the best and the ones that I thought were the worst, and Digiday published that story and published my email. How many of you would subscribe to Digiday to read that story, right? And obviously everybody's hand went up. And that's the kind of reporting that we do in Business Insider.
Okay, that's an answer. What's your biggest subscription generator?
So it really is that. I mean,
your trucking content?
Yeah, trucking content. Actually, that's mostly ad supported, which is really wild. Uh-huh. You know, we've seen a lot of subscribers from the world of finance, so like the big six, like Citi and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. A lot of those people at those companies subscribe to Business Insider Prime, and And we've responded to that, and we've decided to double down on the team, and we are hiring another 5 people this summer to cover finance, and then also enterprise tech and tech in general and media are big areas of focus for us.
And last one, what do you personally regard as your biggest competitor as a paid product? Like, not officially, but yourself, who are you?
I mean, the Wall Street Journal. And I think that we are going head to head with the Wall Street Journal. I think everyone who's listening to this, your company will certainly allow you to expense both. You should do that. But I think our subscription product's going straight after the Wall Street Journal.
I think they are following a really strong community engagement strategy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
Give me one word, one German word that you learned in the course of starting to work with a German owner. There must be at least
one. No, I know a couple. Ich möchte ein Tasse Kaffee, bitte.
Okay, it's time for a Tasse Kaffee. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Nick. That was it. If you like this, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. Give me feedback wherever you find me. I'm Pia Frey on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, etc. Danke fürs Zuhören und bis in 2 Wochen.